My name is Mary and I am an alcoholic. And I'm grateful to be here and grateful to be sober. My dry date is the 10th of August, 1984. My home group is the Markham Village Group in Ontario, Canada. I have a sponsor, and I sponsor women, and I am an active member of my group and of Alcoholics Anonymous. This has been a wonderful conference. I know we say that a lot, but I'll tell you. I have spoken with Don and Sheldon many times, more times than I can ever remember. And this was the best talks I'd ever heard them give. It was quite incredible. So I'd like to thank Jerry, first of all, for calling me and asking me to come. Thank you, Jerry. We've known each other a long time, and Maggie's wife, and it's always great to see you. I love you. I'd like to thank Robert and the committee so very much for everything you've done here. It's been absolutely beautiful. Thank you so much. I'd like to thank the person who did the gift basket. Who did the gift basket? Not here. Thank you. Thank you. And for the cookies and everything, and John and Kathy. Where are they? Oh, John and Kathy. Great to see you. My wonderful hostess, Rebecca, and God keeps putting her in my life, and I'm grateful for that. And Mike and Kathy, the tapers, my dear friends, we've spent a weekend at your home. It's great to see you. Thank you for all the service you do. Thank you. And for Amanda, Amanda was our host at Girl Scout this year. And I'm like, you just do it so well, darling. Thank you so much. You really are. Yeah, thank you. So I love the name of this conference, Designed for Living. You know, it's quite a few years ago, I was speaking somewhere in Hawaii. And we all had a badge on saying a Designed for Living. That was the name of the conference. And quite a few of us were in the elevator. And this man came on with his children. He was not a member. He was not attending the conference. And he says, "A Design for Living. Is this a conference for interior decorators?" I said, "Yeah, in a way it is." You know, Bill said in There Is a Solution, what first seemed to be the flimsy reed turned out to be the loving and powerful hand of God. And that is exactly how it has happened to me. I know without a shadow of a doubt that without God I am nothing. You know, this could so easily be a fairy story. Once upon a time, there was a princess. And somebody gave her something to drink and it poisoned her. And when she was dying of the poison, someone came and took away her children and her jewels, and her home, and all her worldly goods. And then one day a fairy came and sprinkled a little magic dust, and then she got it all back. You know, and the poison for me was the alcohol. The fairy who came was a member of AA, and the magic dust was the 12 steps of Alcoholics Anonymous. I mean, it really is beyond my understanding. Because from where I have come from to where I am today on this Sunday morning, there is no road, there is no bridge. I ended up living in the gutter at the bottom of Lincoln Road on Miami Beach. And there's no way from there without the divine loving hand of God. So I will tell you a little bit about what it used to be like, what happened, and what it's like now. I was born in Glasgow, Scotland. I've got Irish blood and English blood. You know, and what that's like is kind of like Braveheart, St. Patrick, and the Queen all rolled into one. And I was born in 1943. During the war, during the Second World War, they had been bombing the Clyde shipyards just up the road where all the major ships of the world were built in Glasgow. So I was born, like I told you, I was born on high alert, you know. And life just never seemed good to me. From when I could think, life just didn't seem good to me. I was born into a good Roman Catholic family. My father had been a Franciscan monk. He had left the monastery because he had some kind of a theological debate or argument with them. My mother was president of the Union of Catholic Mothers. They never taught me anything but how to be good, and I had no capacity for it. Absolutely none. I was never taught about anything about being bad, and it was just in my nature, in my nature. When I was, I remember the first time I stole anything, it was we had food rationing during the Second World War. There was not a lot of food, and the Americans sent us big crates of beautiful apples. I must have been about seven. That's you. You're Americans, yeah. Thank you. Oh, God, I forget where I am half the time. And we all got a beautiful apple. Because I was already such a sneak and a manipulator, I asked the teacher if I could leave the room, and I went into the cloakroom and stole other people's apples that they had put in their pocket. So just like the Adam and Eve story, my thieving started with an apple and just continued from there. When I was about 13, I did away with God. I don't know why. God didn't make sense to me. My family had suffered a lot of grief. I had two uncles who were both killed in the Second World War, buried in Greece and in Belgium. I had another two uncles who had been in Japanese concentration camps. There had been a lot of grief. Those two uncles who'd been in the concentration camp, they told me what had happened to them. My family just prayed more. I just got more and more and more and more angry and realizing there couldn't be a God. And you know what those uncles told me later on was that their captors had tried to destroy the spirit and had never been able to destroy their spirit. And yet of my own volition, of my own free will, I destroyed my spirit with an innocuous little fluid. I destroyed everything that was good inside of me. And I don't know why I did not have. Bill Wilson talks about a seeming inability to accept much on faith. Alcoholics have a seeming inability to accept much on faith. And I did not have an ability to accept much on faith. And also I had done so many things by then, by lying, cheating and stealing and breaking my mother's heart, that I knew that if there was a God, then he'd written me off. I was educated by nuns. They tried to teach me how to be good, and I had no capacity for it. When I was 15, a nun took a ruler to me. I decided if she could give it, she could take it. And I hit a nun. And see, it's only in AA they laugh at that. Everybody else goes, and we're like, yeah, when did you hit a nun? 1960? Yeah, I hit a nun, you know. So you can make amends, you can make amends. And so I got expelled. And the Mother Superior took me up to her office. And she sat me outside her door. And she said, we have contacted your mother. She said, we have contacted your long-suffering mother. And she'll be coming to pick you up. But while you're waiting for her, I would advise you to try and memorize that sign above my door. And it might do something for your measly little life. And I looked at the sign, and it said, of courtesy, it is much less than courage of heart or holiness. But in my walks to me, it seems that the grace of God isn't courtesy. And way back then, I wanted nothing to do with the grace of God. and I wanted nothing to do with courtesy. But many years later, coming through the doors of Alcoholics Anonymous, I realized it was the grace of God that brought me to you, and it was the great courtesy you extended to a broken down wreck like me that had me stay here. So you see, I believe in what Francis Thompson wrote about the Hound of Heaven. I believe that God was always following me. It was me who had shut him out and didn't want him. And that was the cause of my illness, because I have a spiritual illness. I drink spirit because I have a spiritual illness. When Carl Jung had written to Bill Wilson, he said that he believes that what the alcoholic suffers from at a low level is he has a thirst for a union with God. In medieval language, a thirst for a union of God. He said he drinks spirit, but it's the wrong spirit. He said in Latin, the formula for the alcoholic is spiritus contra spiritum. Instead of drinking spirit for the spiritual malady, we take in a spiritual program of action. Isn't that simple and beautiful? I'm getting very spiritual this morning. I don't know. And John, so unlike me, what happened? Let's get down to the real me before. So anyway, at 13, too, I started having panic attacks. Anybody in here ever had panic attacks? Wow, you see? And they are absolutely isolating, and they are absolutely, they are terrifying. And my family, I told my family about these panic attacks, and my mother tried to help. Nobody could help. And of course, my family, they're a few bricks short of a load, my family. For example, I have an aunt, and she can be sitting having a cup of tea, and all of a sudden she freezes in time. And people will come up and say, what happened to her? And my family will say, she's just away. She'll soon be back. You know. And the other thing was, I was very different. I was very different, and I couldn't make friends. And everybody thought I was odd. And I was very odd because I was nervous. I didn't like people. I was inclined to hit you if you didn't smile at me. You know, because I was very fearful, and that turned to aggression. And I just had no ease and comfort in the world. Look, let me just say this. I always knew there was something seriously wrong with me long before I drank. And the reason I knew there was something seriously wrong with me is because people were always saying to me, there's something seriously wrong with you. Now, I did not know that my solution was alcohol. Nobody knew my solution was alcohol. So I went on my merry way, and, got thrown out my first job for stealing. I manipulated the books because I didn't know how to manipulate the books. It just came naturally. It's just a talent. I didn't think they were paying me enough money, so I decided to pay myself. And, of course, I got found out, and my poor, long-suffering mother was contacted, and and then I decided to try and make good. And if I sat an IQ test, I could get into nursing, and I sat an IQ test, and I got accepted into nursing for my registered nursing. Eventually, I got bored with that. Then I said to myself, there's nothing seems to be fitting, nothing seems to be helping me. I'm going crazy. I'm trying everything I know. I'm trying not to make my mother proud of me. I'm trying to stop being a bad girl. I'm trying to do, and yet I have this craziness going on inside of me. It was an unbearable, unsheddable burden of self-consciousness. It was a pathological self-consciousness. So everywhere I went, I thought that you were looking at me and finding me wanting. I thought that every room I walked into, every bus I went onto, everywhere I went in the world, people were looking at me and saying, there's something wrong with her. Something wrong with her. And it was unbearable to walk around the world like that. There's only one description, apart from AA, that I've ever found that relates to that state I felt. And it was by an American poet called Anne Sexton, who died of alcohol-related problems. And she wrote, I have a body and I cannot escape from it. I would like to fly out of my mind, but it is out of the question. It is written in the tablet of human destiny that I am stuck here in this human form. That being so, I'd like to call attention to my problem. I wanted to call attention to my problem that I don't feel good enough for the world, that I feel different, that I feel less than, that I feel as if I'm on the outside looking in, that I feel as if there's just something that will never be right with me, so maybe I should just not be here. Maybe I'm just a waste of good skin. That's what it felt like. So then all of my peers, I won't say friends because I didn't have any, they were all dating. So I decided that I would date. So eventually some guy asked me out, and I don't know if it's like this in America, but in Scotland when they take you out at the end of the night, they want a reward. Now remember, by this time I'm not well. I'm completely and utterly obsessed by death. I mean obsessed by death, obsessed with dying, but I'm just not in good shape. So I'm with this guy and he's getting really passionate. And I'm kind of a detached, watching him, thinking about myself and my mind. And then... because I'm seeking understanding, I said to him at the height of his passion, so what do you think about death? He said, I think you should go home now. So I went on my merry way and... eventually went down to London, England. I got a job with British Airways. Back then it was called BOAC. And at age 21, I was in uniform. I'm flying all over the world. I'm up in a plane with all these people. I don't like people. I'm claustrophobic. And I'm having panic attacks. It was not a good career choice. So I decided that I went to a psychiatrist and he couldn't help me. And I tried to explain to him, and the only buddy who's ever been able to understand how I felt was an alcoholic. He couldn't understand it. He just said, with your genes, you're all kind of, he didn't say who his was, but he kind of said that. Ireland's an open-air asylum, and Sigmund Freud said you couldn't analyse the Irish mind, the Gaelic mind, whatever. So I decided to get married. I thought, if I get married... I thought, if I get married and have children, maybe I'll be normal. So I get married. I married a really nice man, and he married a figment of my imagination. And he took me to live in Kingston, Jamaica. And in Jamaica, I had everything that money could buy. And then I had my BMW. And then I had we had a beautiful home. And after a year, my first son was born. And just after he was born, what should have been the happiest moment of my life, because I loved this little boy. I looked at this baby and I could not believe I had brought anything into the world so perfect. A couple of weeks after he was born, I thought I was going insane. I was 25 years of age. I had walked the world without a drink, without a drug, without anybody understanding how I felt. And at the happiest time in my life, I thought, I'm going into psychosis. I'm going to go mad and I'll never come back. And they brought a doctor and he wanted to give me an injection. And a friend said, give her a drink. And Jamaica has 151 proof rum. Has anybody ever had 151 proof rum? Is it not beautiful? Memories. I drank that 151 proof rum, and I don't know if it was the first, the second, or the third drink. But it went all the way deep down inside of me like a piece of velvet. And it wrapped itself around every raw nerve ending I had been walking around with for 25 years. And for the first time in my life, my skin fit. That's all. I got what Dr. Silkworth talks about when he says men and women get a sense of ease and comfort. That's what I got. If I didn't get that, I wouldn't have drank it. It was magnificent. It was my magical elixir, my genie in a bottle. And I drank every day on a daily basis. Someone told me, a doctor, I can't remember, that I was probably going into postpartum psychosis when I took that drink. I don't know if that's true, but it certainly explains something. But it certainly explains, too, the transformative power for me, an alcoholic of my type, alcohol. I heard a hypothetical once that was very interesting to me. It said you take 100 people and you put them in a room and you give them cocaine for a month. And at the end of a month, you're going to have 100 people addicted to cocaine. You take another 100 people and you put them in a room and give them alcohol for a month, and at the end of a month you'll have 6 or 7% alcoholics. Because you can't drink yourself into alcoholism. Because it's a threefold disease that has a predisposition based on a certain personality type. It's quite interesting to me. But all I know is that whatever alcohol did for me, it was magic. And I drank every day on a daily basis. And it was magnificent. And I had the best life I've ever had for 4 years. 4. Because it says women go down the road. I drank every day. I got pregnant at the end of that. Just when I was really getting bad, I got pregnant with my second son. Now, I didn't know. I had lost the power of choice in drink by then. You know, it's not that I was falling down drunk. I was just drinking every day. It was like a maintenance. It was like a medication. Self-medicating. That's what I was doing. And I wasn't a falling down drunk. And I was drinking every day I carried my second son. And I never thought not to do that. Because I couldn't not do it. Because I'd fall apart. And I don't know why my boy wasn't born with fetal alcohol syndrome, but he wasn't. And I can't say that was the grace of God, because how come God doesn't say, okay, your child will have fetal alcohol syndrome and yours won't? It just didn't happen. And by that time now, the cucumber has become a pickle. And once you reach that stage, you can never go back. And now I don't know what's going to happen to me when I drink. I go to the country club in Jamaica. Sometimes I behave well. I go and sometimes I don't. Sometimes somebody doesn't like what I said and disagree with me. And I'll pick up a bottle and break it and challenge them to a duel. And my husband said, what the hell is wrong with you? There's something wrong with you. You know, my husband he developed a nervous disposition, which is all my husbands, because I used to say to him, if you drop asleep tonight, I'll kill you. And he, you know, he used to run and lock himself in rooms when I passed out. I did try to kill him. I hit him with a piece of mahogany. I'm sorry about that. I didn't kill him. And his parents came to talk to me and said, "I don't know what's wrong with you. Nobody knows what's wrong with you. You used to be a lovely girl. We called your mother." Well, they did call my mother, and they said, "There's something seriously wrong with your daughter." My mother said, "There was always something wrong with her." I had some friends, and they said to me, "Mary, we're all worried about you. Come and smoke a little sensimilla, man. Come have a little ganja. Look how the liquor's making your eyes red." I said, "I don't want nothing that's going to screw up my brain. I'll stick to liquor. Thank you." Anyway, they took me up into the mountains where all the Rastafarians are, up in the mountains of Jamaica. And the Rastafarians are very peaceful people. The alcohol is against their religion, but they smoke a lot of pot. And my friends seem to know at some level that maybe a spiritual life would be good. And the Rastafarians, they read from the Old Testament. And I went up and I watched them. And I watched one of them. He rolled a spliff and it was so big you couldn't even see his face. You know? And he went, "I just want to mellow out, man. Have a little vision." And he'd lay down and meditate. That's not me. When I drink, I want action. When I drink, I want justice. When I drink, I want love. I will eventually end up lying down whether I want to or not. So I knew that wasn't my solution. And, I never get away. Recently I haven't been telling this, but somebody said, "Tell the Bob Marley story." Bob Marley used to live across the road from me on Hope Road in Kingston, Jamaica. His record producer had given him a big, big old great house. Now, Bob didn't like me. Bob didn't like me because I was a drunk and he was a Rastafarian and alcohol is against his religion. I didn't like Bob because he was a pothead. Anyway, Bob had a BMW, I had a BMW, and one day, and you know, Bob was a great humanitarian. Bob really cared for people. Everything he ever said, he meant. He used to feed the poor people. He did more for the poor people in Jamaica than any government. He was a good man. But I didn't like him because I'm selfish, self-centered, and self will run riot. And one day I'm in the garage waiting for my car to be filled up, and he took my inventory. I'm standing kind of a half in the bag, swaying in the breeze with my Dunhill cigarette lighter, thinking about myself. And Bob comes up in his BMW and he shouts across at me and he calls out my name and he said, "You're a hedonist and a narcissist and you don't care about anybody but yourself. You drink your liquor and you think you're smart." I said, "I am known to have some intellect." He said, "If you think you're so smart, what does BMW stand for?" I said, "Bavarian Motor Works." He says, "No, man, it means Bob Marley and the Wailers." Anyway, eventually I decided to leave the island because that's what I do. I run and I run and I run and away, but I can't run away from myself. Everywhere I go, I take myself along. But you see, my thing is, if things get too hot, I'm off. I'm leaving. But I'm going everywhere I go. And unfortunately, I told my husband if he didn't give me custody of my kids, that because I love my kids, but I was a chronic alcoholic. I should never have been allowed to leave the island. But you see, I'm a terrible human being. And I told him, "If you don't let me take those children, I'm going to print something in the newspaper about you." And eventually I took them. I went back to Scotland. They told me about my drinking. And then a man said, "Let's get married." Magic words. I love getting married. I love getting married. I just don't have any follow through. And he said, "I'll take you to Canada. And that's what happened. I married this man. I married this man as a way out, as a runaway ticket, you know, get me into Canada. I didn't want to go to Canada, but I had no option because I didn't want to stay in Scotland. And I took my two sons, married this man. By this time, I'm shaking so much, I can't get my drink up in the morning. And I got a job as a pharmaceutical rep. I realized I had a Valium deficiency. And my territory was huge. I had a huge territory. I was supposed to drive 60,000 clicks a year. Kilometres a year, and I was a blackout drinker on the road. And then I sent that good man away. He was a nice man, and I sent him away, because that's what happens to me. I'm a user, a taker, and I have no respect for any human being and any child of God. And now it's just me and my two little boys, and I drive with them drunk in the car. I never physically abuse my children, but I am an alcoholic mother. And my children saw things that no innocent child could ever see. And I'm so sorry about that. And I would give anything to be able to do it again and give them the innocent childhood that they need. We do terrible damage to our children. This alcoholism is a destroyer of children, a destroyer of lives. It's very sad. And I lost that job. I got into trouble with the police. My family came, put me in detox, and I got out and I decided to go back to Jamaica. And unbeknownst to me, my eldest son, who was now 11, had written to his daddy and did something that no 11-year-old boy should ever have to do. But because our children are children of alcoholics, they do things and say things that they shouldn't have to do. And my little boy wrote to his daddy and said, "When we come back to Jamaica, we're supposed to be with you for a week. But I never want to live with mommy again because I love her, but she's going to kill my brother and me driving drunk. And she brings men home." So when I went back to Jamaica with my boys, the children's father asked, he was married again, and he asked if he could have them for a week. And they were gone for 13 years. And when I found out I wasn't getting them back, I didn't want to live anymore. And I had an old rented house in Hope Road in Kingston, Mona Pastures in Kingston. And I went back there. He said if I tried to get the children, he'd put my son in the stand, and he had all the money. And I knew it was hopeless, and I didn't want to live anymore. I had tried so hard to stay sober for my children. I'd tried time after time. I'd done everything. I'd kept them for 2 years in Canada without any support, because he wouldn't pay me child support when I was living in Canada. I did everything in my power. If I could have stopped drinking, I would have stopped. I love my children. But I am in the grip of a demon called alcohol. And nothing. Can make me stop drinking, because when I stop drinking, I go mad. I go mad when I stop drinking, and I have to drink. And I say, I'll just have one. And then I set off the phenomena of craving, and it is a nightmare. And I drank two bottles of Valium and two bottles of 151 proof rum. I wanted to die. I locked myself in the house and I said, I'm going to die. I want to die gently. It's funny. We alcoholics, we really, really, really want to die sometimes. But we don't want to hurt ourselves. It's true. It's a phenomena. I really want to die. But I'm not going to slash my wrist because I don't like blood. I'm not going to jump off the building. But maybe I can drink myself into death. But alcoholics are hard to dead. We do not die easy. When alcoholics say to me, if I drink again, I'll be dead, I say, you wish. Some of us live forever drinking. And a friend came and she figured something was wrong and she broke down the door and she pulled me out in the carpet and they took me up to Kingston University Hospital and they pumped out my stomach. And I came to and I was so angry at being alive. And the next day a psychiatrist came and told me something that was very observant, intellectually correct, and definitely relevant to my condition. He said, "You mustn't do that anymore." I ended up having to leave Jamaica. The children's father said if I didn't leave Jamaica, he'd kill me or have me killed. And he gave me the 2 years back money he owed me for child support. I went to Miami. I didn't know anybody in Miami. I got an apartment, but I'm a hopeless alcoholic. And I'd leave my door open, and they'd come in and they'd steal my furniture. They'd steal my clothes. They'd steal my jewelry. They'd steal me. I was a woman alcoholic all alone, living in a building, and had no family for 5,000 miles, apart from my children in Jamaica. And eventually I got thrown out of there and I ended up living on the street. My life down there was like going through a sewer and a glass-bottom boat. And there's no need to go into details here, but I would just tell you that this alcoholism, it leaves you where you have no femininity, you have no humanity left. It leaves you to a place, be you male or female, where if you be in the street, and if you be a hopeless alcoholic like me, people will take you up and use you and throw you away like an old piece of cloth. So you have no self-worth and nothing left of good and value in your life. That's what it does. And you never think you will come out of that morass of muck that you're living in. Hopeless. A hopeless condition of mind and body. But one day this old woman came, an old English woman that used to live in Jamaica, and now she lived in Fort Lauderdale. I asked her for money. My family had said they were looking for me. My father had woken up one night, 3 o'clock in the morning, and said to my mother, "I don't know where my lassie is. I don't know where my grandchildren are. I'm going for a walk," and went out and dropped dead in the street at the same time I was living on the street. Such is my legacy to my father. And my family came and cleaned me up, and I went to Canada, and I'll just rush this thing up. In Canada, a man married me again. He said, he thought he could take care of me, you know. And, you know, I said it before, what happens to me is I fall in love, and him and me are like Velcro. And then after we get married, and after about a month, maybe two, I can hear him breathing 3 doors down. Did he always breathe like that, you know? You know, just nothing's wonderful after you're used to it. For me, nothing. And the first time I tried to kill him, he took me... He took me to a psychiatrist, and the second time they put me in the mental institution. And 4 years in and out the mental institutions. And I loved being in there. They treated me as a manic depressive. Alcoholism looks a lot like manic depression. And I love it. I love the yum-yums, the lithium, the librium, the valium, the yum-yum. And the last time I was taken in there, I was taken by the police, and I was in a lot of trouble. Now, the psychiatrist, he said to me, "We're sending you for assertiveness therapy." I said, "I don't need assertiveness therapy. I'm in here because I tried to kill my husband." He said, "That's not assertive, that's aggressive. Alcoholics don't have enough self-esteem to be assertive." That's interesting, isn't it? We'd rather kill somebody than be assertive. That's very interesting. really. I mean, such insights. And then they sent me to, used to send me to AA meetings. They used to bring AA meetings into the institution, and they'd make me go. But I never heard anything because I was so full of yum-yums. And the AA members told me later that they used to say to me, "Do you have any hope?" And I'd say, "I have no hope." And I had no hope. I was hopeless. Anyway, when I got out of there, I had to go to court and I had to go through all the police stuff. And the judge called me a tragic social circumstance, and I was a tragic social circumstance till I came to you. One night I was drinking myself sober. I picked up the phone and I phoned AA. A man came who had 28 years sobriety. His name was Stan. He was a Metis. A Metis means he is Native Indian and French. 28 years sobriety. And he told me his story. He said, "Mari, tell," it was 3 o'clock in the morning. In the real dark night of the soul, it's always 3 o'clock in the morning. Right? And he told me his story. He said, "Mari, tell me a little bit about you." And I could not believe listening to him. This man, who was Native American, French, was talking about things that in my 40 years, I had never identified with anybody else in the world. He's talking about the things that had separated me all my life. I could not believe it. He said, "Tell me a little bit about you." And because I'm terminally unique, I said, "Jim Stan, I know I'm an alcoholic, but I'm also nuts. I got a psychiatric report that says I'm nuts, that I'll have to be on medication for the rest of my life." He said, "Mari, the 12 steps of Alcoholics Anonymous is like 12 adjustable wrenches. They're for any nut that comes through the door." I had one slip. My dry date is the 10th of August, 1984. On the 9th of August, 1984, I was in very bad shape. But Stan and these other people didn't give up on me. I was trying to stop drinking. They came and they took me to a meeting. They told me I was in such bad shape. I was shaking so much, strangers were waving back at me. And that night, my angel, my fairy, my little AA gal spent the night with me. She had 12 years sobriety. And the next day she said to me, "I'm going to leave, you know, because my sponsor said you're a loser. And I only stick with winners and Alcoholics Anonymous. But before I go, I'm going to ask you to kneel down and say the third step prayer." And I said to her, "I kneel for nothing." And then something said, "Think of your children's eyes." And I knelt down and I held her hands. And I got a vision. And the vision was, the previous Christmas, I just got out of the mental institution. I was on a lot of medication. And I called my family in Scotland to arrange for me to see my kids in Jamaica. And they said, okay. So the father said, okay. And I called my ex-husband in Jamaica. He said, "You can come for a week. You can have them for 5 days at Christmas. Oh, you have to check into a certain hotel in Kingston, and I'll come and check up on you to make sure you're not drinking." And he put my boys on the phone. He said, Mommy, we heard you had another nervous breakdown. We can't wait to see you. We really miss you, Mommy." My boys had to grow up without a mother to kiss away the boo-boos, to tell them stories, bedtime stories, to pat their backs when they did something really good, to cheer them on at games, to give them that little cuddle that only a mom and a dad can really give them that makes them feel secure. That's what alcohol took away from my children. I said, "What do you want for Christmas?" And they told me. I got on the plane in Edmonton, Alberta. I had to change in Toronto to get an Air Jamaica flight to Kingston. I bought a bottle of vodka and I drank it from Toronto to Kingston. When I got off the plane in Kingston, my children were standing with the person who brought them to the airport, shouting, "Mommy, Mommy, Mommy," and I dropped down drunk at their feet. And the person who brought them said, "You won't be seeing your mother this trip, boys." And led my sons away. And I remember lying on the ground, looking at my children, looking over their shoulder with the eyes of the child of the alcoholic. The broken promises and broken dreams one more time. And that's what I thought about, kneeling down. And I said the third step prayer. And from that moment to this, I've had no desire for a drink since the 10th of August, 1984, praying to a God I didn't believe in, because in one moment of ultimate despair, it broke me open enough for God's grace to enter, and I'm so grateful. And I got very active in AA, and I did everything I was told to do, because I wanted this thing. I had a desire. You know, in the old days, it used to talk about an honest desire for this thing. And now we just say a desire. But this desire we have, there is no spiritual Viagra. You cannot create desire. The desire to get sober, the desire for the spiritual way of living, it comes from a place of hopelessness and despair. That's what creates this desire, where you will go to any lengths to get what this thing gives you, which is a participation in a miracle. I will never take it for granted. At 6 weeks, I did my fourth and fifth. I got a sponsor. I did everything she told me to do. I got active. And I loved my life. And then I had to leave that husband because I had married him and I didn't care about him, and I had to make amends to him and get honest with him. I moved to Toronto. I saw my son for a year when he went to school in Toronto, and back and forth making amends. I did everything I was told to do. And I did the fourth and fifth early because I couldn't stand myself. You see, I wanted this thing with every fiber of my being. So I had to resign from the debate in society. I had to realize that I don't know what's good for me. You do. I had to trust in your judgment. Because if you had all these years of sobriety, you must be doing something right. And you have a life that I want, which means that you have some, I see in you some peace. And I want peace. I see in you some serenity. I see in you a love of God that seems to be real. I want that. And sometimes you may have to act as if you believe, but do it. Because without God, there's nothing for me. And my sons were acting up, and I went back to Jamaica for 2 years. My sponsor told me to go back and make amends to the island. My sons had been put out the father's house for various things, and eventually they came back and we lived together. And after 13 years, they came back and we lived together in Canada for a couple of years. It was beautiful. I got married when I was in AA. It didn't work out, but he had a stroke eventually, and I looked after him. I was able to make amends to him. You know, I went back and forth to Scotland making amends. My brother had a baby born, a little boy called Richard, who's now 28. He was born without arms and a club foot. And I was able to go back when that little baby was born and be there for my brother that I'd never been there for. And I go every year. You know, my aunts who came and took me off the street, I've been able to go back and look after them in their old age. Every year I go back. Every year I go back and they say to me, every time they see me, they say to me, "Has that AA found out what's wrong with you yet?" Now here's the thing. And these I'll be 33 years sober, please God, on the 10th of August. I haven't wanted to drink in that time, but I've had problems. I've had a lot of problems, you know, like we do. Life is problems. You know, just because you get an AA, you're not immune from having life problems. You know, we have to do life. And for some of us, it's very difficult to do life. And for some of us, it's very difficult to have relationships. You know, it just is the most difficult thing. And we need guidance. And also sometimes we have to learn that problems are just, sometimes they're learning things. I have found that my life has become the outcome of the decisions I've made. And a lot of times the decisions I've made have been good decisions because I've always gone to my sponsor. My sponsees tell me that I always seem to have the right answer. Right, Aoife? One of my sponsees is here. It's so good to see her. My sponsees tell me I always seem to have the right answer for them. But when I'm in emotional turmoil, I don't know what's good for me. Even today, I got to call my sponsor. And my sponsor will tell me something and I'll do it. And usually the answer he has for me is right on. Always. So I need my sponsor more today than I've ever done, because my life and your life will become the outcome of the choices you make. Bill Wilson said once, you know, if we have something to make a decision about, we make a decision and we act on it. And if it works out well, we thank God. And if it doesn't work out well, we thank God for the experience and we try something else. And the self-worth that you got in here, that I got in here, because I came from a place where I was broken, where I felt like a piece of old rubbish. And the self-esteem I got and the sense of well-being came from being of service to other people. Service is a gift from God. Service is what makes you get a little self-esteem, a little feeling happy. And any time I'm feeling unhappy, I pick up the phone and I phone some people. Pick up the £500 phone. I no longer get into my own head. I can still be completely fascinated by myself. Find myself an amazing subject for study. Ponder the immensities of myself. But then I get outmaneuvered by reality. And the reality is that I got to do something to get myself. And I'll just share this and then I'll sit down. I am told that I have a spiritual reprieve from my illness. Not drinking. My illness. See, my illness continues. My illness centers in the mind, not the body. I suffer from something called alcoholism, not alcoholism. And that means that every morning I wake up with the mind of an alcoholic. The mind of an alcoholic that can say, he didn't look at me right last night. Life looks grey today. There's something wrong with me today. Let me spend the day thinking about myself. And I have to get in fit spiritual condition before I go out and hit the street. Right? Where there's people, places and things. And I'll share this little story and sit down. I'm better than I ever was. My sponsor tells me that too. I'm kinder, gentler, caring. I want to be a citizen of the world, like Bill Wilson said. But I have an illness. And one morning, I heard there was tissues on sale at my pharmacy. Now, I use a lot of tissues because I have rhinitis. Now, I have never given a fig about the external of a tissue box. I don't care about the external. I just want the tissues. So I rushed down early one morning to get some of these fantastic deals on tissues. And there's a woman down there before me. And she's picking out all the boxes with flowers on them. Now, because I am a citizen of the world, and I want everything to be fair, I decided to point this out to her. So I said to her, excuse me, you're taking out all the boxes with flowers on them. She said, I only like the ones with flowers on them. I said, me too. And I started. And I'm fighting her for these boxes. And in the end, she has 11 with a certain pattern. I have one with that pattern. She said, if you give me that, I'll have a dozen. I said, no. I said to myself, there's something not right here. I called my sponsor. My sponsor said, bit immature, wasn't it? He said, I want you to carry that box around in the trunk of your car and give it to that woman if you ever see her, make up a dozen and think about your behavior. And I realized that that study done by Yale or Harvard on alcoholics at various stages of sobriety and various ages said that the consistencies amongst all of us were emotional immaturity and deep sensitivity. That is the bugaboos that will be with us until we die. So I want to thank you so much. I have a great life today. I have 5 grandkids. I have loving sons. They call me 2-3 times a week. I took my 2 granddaughters to Scotland last year. They're both aged 16. I was with my sons for New Year's. They call me and tell me how much they love me. I have a life beyond my wildest dreams. Bill Wilson, our co-founder, said Alcoholics Anonymous is not a success story. Rather, it is the chronicle of our colossal human failure turned to usefulness by the divine alchemy of a loving God. And thank you.